Hey, this episode of the Story Time Podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get your free 30-day Audible trial and a free audiobook of your choosing by going to audibletrial.com/paranormal. It's a free audiobook. Go grab it.
With Bran,
and with for the first time ever, better vocal clarity from Dave.
Wow, that's great. I'm literally on the road. I'm not just like saying that. I'm literally driving right now.
So you're hitting the road there, Bran, punching the old highway.
Yeah, I'm hitting the old the old pavement, asphalt.
Bran, I'm excited. Do you want to know why?
What's that?
I said I'm excited. Do you want to know why?
Why are you excited?
Because this is the first time that I got us an interview.
Wow. Yeah, you really went for it. And I said, thanks for doing a little bit of work. I'm going to just let you do all of it.
Yeah, so Bran, do you want to like, are you ready to just like interview this guy with me?
No. Don't want to.
No, you're just gonna stay on the old road.
Yeah, I'm gonna stay on the road, and then maybe you can just tell me after the fact how it is.
Yeah, that sounds like one of the ways.
Tell me about how you got this guy. Why'd you get him?
Well, as you'll see, he's a smart one. He's a guy that's worked for many companies. On a lot of products projects, I should say, that kind of got canceled. But we're talking nuclear stuff, Bran, nuclear. And the type of people that he talks to about the aliens are the smartest of us. And so he's been kind of in a very niche area doing the proclamation of UFO-ology, I should say.
And, that's awesome. I'm really excited to...
But, Bran, do you want to know how I... Like, the reason that we kind of, like, even found him was because he, at one point, debated Mark Sargent, who was the flat earth theorist guy that we had on...
Sargent!
So we'll get into that a little bit, probably, at the end, for about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. It's a quickie, huh?
It's a quickie. I mean, what else is there to say aside from, well, not on the same page as that one. But anyway, so...
Yeah. That's great, Dave. I'm really proud. I'm really proud of you. I feel like a dad who's letting his kid run wild.
Mm. Yeah. Well, here goes this kid into the highway. Hope you don't run me over with the car.
Life. You know what they say? Life is a highway.
Who?
And I want to ride it all night long.
Who did it?
I don't know. Hey. I'm really excited to listen to this. I'm not going to ask anything. I'm just going to listen to how you do it, and maybe I'll take some notes, and maybe I'll learn from the student.
Here's the pebble. Good luck.
What do you say we just go ahead and get it? We'll go to a quick break, and then we'll listen to you interview Stan.
Good that you're still trying to dictate when things are happening, but Bran, it looks like I'm in the driver's seat. So I'm gonna say.
Okay, tell me what's next. What do you want to do? What do you want to talk about?
All right, we're gonna go take a break now. Hey, Bran.
Oh, what's up, man?
Boy, are you driving still?
I'm actually currently I'm stopped. But that's just because I'm about to get a little bit of copies.
Oh, yeah. Are you reading any books right now?
No, but I'm actually listening to one.
Oh, really? What is it?
Yeah. I don't remember the title, but it's really good. It's
could have even made up one.
Serial killer.
Oh, it's one of those ones. So you could have even
made I can look it up. Let me look it up right now. I'm going to open up my Audible app on my iPhone.
Oh, Audible, what's that?
Yeah, well, I'm currently listening to a book called The Devil in the White City.
I've heard of it.
And I'm listening to it via Audible, which is an application that I have on my phone, but you can have on whatever electronic device you so choose. And you can get yourself an audiobook on Audible. They have over 180,000 of them, and you can listen to an audiobook just like me.
Yay.
But I got good news for you, Dave, because I kind of feel like you're interested.
Mm-hmm. You have me on the line.
Yeah, I'd say, why don't you go ahead and go to audibletrial.com/paranormal, because here's what you're going to get if you do that. A free audio book from Audible.
Audiobooks. I love them.
Audiobook. Crazy. That's audibletrial.com/paranormal, Dave. Not paranormal, Dave, but like paranormal.
I'll race you there.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, if you don't get it, someone else will, but that's okay. We got enough to go around for everybody. Audibletrial.com/paranormal. Dave, get your free audiobook today.
Okay, and we're back. And today we have a special guest, Stanton T. Friedman. Is that how you say it? Right?
That's right.
Friedman? Okay. Stanton, and he go by Stan, so I'm going to continue this going by Stan. Okay, so Stan is a nuclear physicist, author, lecturer, and he received his BSc and MSc degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 1956. He was employed for 14 years as a nuclear physicist by such companies as GE, GM, Westinghouse, Ashland Nuclear Laboratory, TRW Systems, Acrojet, General Nucleonics, and this is a mouthful, McDonnell Douglas Aeronautics, working in such highly advanced classified, eventually canceled programs as nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various compact nuclear power plants for space and terrestrial applications. So as you guys will soon find out, this guy's way smarter than me or Brandon, and as we mentioned earlier, Brandon is not with us, so he'll have to listen back to this one to have his mind blown. Okay, so Stan, could you kind of start things off by giving a kind of a background on how you got interested in UFOs and how your background led you to that?
Well, I had no particular interest in UFOs. I read a lot of science fiction when I was a kid, but when I was working as a nuclear physicist for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department way back in 1958, we had a major program going. We spent $100 million that year. We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. So this wasn't a few professors and a few grad students. It was a major effort. $100 million is a lot of money in 1958.
It's a lot of money now.
yeah, I think so, too, frankly. And my wife and I used to order a lot of books from mail-order bookhouses, discount bookhouses, and we'd ordered a bunch, we had a list ready, and we needed one more book so we wouldn't have to pay shipping. And I was looking through the list, and there was the report on unidentified flying objects by Air Force Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who had headed Project Blue Book a few years earlier in the early 50s, the Air Force effort concerned with UFOs. And it sounded intriguing. And it was marked down from $2.95 to $1, a hardcover book. It wasn't going to cost anything because the shipping would have been $1 if I hadn't picked one more book. So what the heck? I'm a bargain hunter, you know. And got the book, read it. It intrigued me. It didn't totally convince me. And I hadn't had a previous opinion because I didn't know anything. I'm a firm believer. I was in high school debating, and I was a firm believer in have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. But I loaned the book to my neighbor, who was a good engineer. He was 10 years older than I was, Charlie. And he was more impressed than I was, and I was impressed by that because I was impressed with Charlie. And I was a young squirt at 24. And so read more books, but we both went our own ways. 10 years later, Charlie came to a lecture that I've given, one of more than 700, at an electrical engineering group, and the first thing he said to me was, he was with his wife, we knew you when you didn't believe in flying saucers, which made me feel good. Anyway, I moved out to California, had a good librarian. I think I've set a record for working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs.
Right, you had a long list on there. A lot of cool stuff, though.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I thought I'd be like my father, who worked for the same company for 37 years. But I was a three-year man. 3 years here, 3 years there, 3 years someplace else. They canceled the programs. Anyway, I was in California, read about 10 books, and then the big moment came. It was at the University of California, Berkeley Library. And I found a copy of something that hadn't been mentioned in any of the books that I had read. And it was chock full of data. Project Blue Book, Special Report number 14. Had data on 3,201 sightings, hundreds of charts, tables, graphs, maps. I was in data heaven. But the guy who put this whole thing together included, this was done for the Air Force by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, a very well-respected research and development firm. And it included the press release that went out in 1955, went out all over the place. They didn't distribute the report worth talking about, but they did distribute the press release. And in this press release, the Secretary of the Air Force, no less, said, on the basis of this study, we believe that no objects such as those popularly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Well, that seems to solve the problem. The only trouble was I had the report, and I'm looking at the tables and charts and graphs. He's lying through his teeth. That bugged me, because the unknowns weren't 3%. They were 21.5%. That's not 3 rounded off where I come from.
Anyway. Right.
And they had done quality evaluations. They found the better the quality of the sighting because of the background of the observer, the duration of observation, that sort of stuff, the more likely to be unexplainable. I'm only interested in the ones that can't be explained. I don't care about the ones that can be. They also did a cross comparison between the unknowns and the knowns on the basis of 6 different characteristics: apparent size, color, shape, speed, that sort of thing, the observables.
Right.
And they found that the probability that the unknowns were just misknowns was less than 1%. And the duration of observation was longer for the unknowns than for the knowns. It was a tremendous amount of data. And I was determined. I don't like being lied to. I mean, when you work under security, sometimes you have to sort of tiptoe around the truth. But flat out lying like that? So I wanted to get to the bottom of the question. What's really going on here?
Right.
And I joined APRO and NICAP, which were the two major groups back then, not long gone, to get their newsletters and stuff, and read a bunch more books. And my job ended, and I got another job in Indianapolis, and that's where Frank Edwards was. And Frank was a journalist who had written a best-selling book, A Flying Saucer, Serious Business. And I got to know him, and he sent me a copy of his book when I moved to Pittsburgh to work for Westinghouse Astronuclear Laboratory on nuclear rocket engines. Very exciting program, and we had great success with the program, and then they canceled it, of course. But
the common theme.
That's the way things seem to go. Right. And I got my first lecture. It was funny. I asked Frank for names of people who, media guys, figuring that because I was a nuclear physicist working for Westinghouse in Pittsburgh, which is a Westinghouse stronghold, that they'd want me on their program. Great name for a program, Contact. And it was on the biggest station in Pittsburgh, KDKA. And much to my surprise and disappointment, the guy I talked to, who indeed was the producer for Contact, don't call us, we'll call you. Well, less than a month later, he called me at 6:30. Could I do the 7 o'clock show, please? Somebody had canceled at the last minute. And I've often wondered how many people did he call before he got to me. I live close to the station. And, yeah, I could do the show. This was 6:30, 7 o'clock show, but I was close. So I did it. And somebody at work at Westinghouse, technician, heard me on the air and said, Stan, we're reading Frank's book. She had a book review club. And how about giving us a lecture about flying saucers at my home? Okay, that was my first lecture. And they seemed to like it, and I liked it, and I did that program and did several other lectures. And then the big break came. One day of 2 in 3 years, I rode into work with Joanne, who was a supervisor, had a PhD from Carnegie Mellon. And I lived downtown. She lived downtown. My car was in the garage, so she gave me a ride out to Westinghouse. Was at a small town called Large, which was out of town. So we're talking. I said, gee, I'd like to speak at Carnegie Mellon. Well, did you talk to the dean? No, I talked to Dr. So-and-so, and he wasn't interested. He said, Stan, the dean's my husband. He's heard you on the radio. Why don't you give him a call? Okay.
I heard
you. So I did. And with a connection like that, we booked a talk for like 3 weeks later. But it was an afternoon talk, which meant I'd have to take some time off work at Westinghouse. And
oh, yeah,
the last question he asked me was, how much do you want? And I thought, yeah, how about $100? I figured he'd knock me down to 50. Well, he bought the 100. And then he told me, because I knew his wife, what he was paying the other people in the series, $1,500, $1,700, $1,600. Well, okay, the talk went extremely well. Big crowd, nice questions, sensible responses. And he sent a letter to the agent through whom he had booked me, and in Boston. And believe it or not, the guy is still booking people. He booked the talk for me last year. I didn't even know he was still alive. Out in California at a much higher price, I might add. Anyway, he sent a letter to this agent, and he booked me at the Engineering Society of Detroit. Now, you can't get more respectable than that. And I was getting $300 in expenses. Wow, I mean, it isn't far from Pittsburgh to Detroit, but still, it was a step up from 100.
Yeah.
And they were sold out. I found out, much to my surprise, that they were sold out for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, sold out a week in advance. And there were no negative questions.
Wow.
Now, I had to respect that. I mean, this Engineering Society of Detroit, even though I buy Japanese cars, still, these are legitimate people. They're not little old ladies in tennis shoes.
Absolutely.
And it was their enthusiastic response, which, of course, encouraged me. And I gave more talks to professional groups. There weren't many physicists around talking about flying saucers, I'll guarantee you that. And I asked my management, I need some guidance, I said. I don't want to lose my clearance or my job. I got a wife and kids and a mortgage and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, give me some guidance here. I enjoy speaking, and, you know, I need to know what the rules are, though. So they came back to me a few days later with three rules. You can identify yourself as a Westinghouse nuclear physicist. You can say what you please on your time. But we'd like you to start your lecture with a disclaimer that the views you're about to hear are mine and mine alone and not those of my employer. Now, who could ask for anything more than that? Right. There are so many people in academia that are afraid to admit their interest, you know. Well, as it happens, I did ask for something more. I got a call from a colleague at Los Alamos National Laboratory. He was working on nuclear rocket engines, which is what I was working on, both in radiation shielding, which is an important part of the problem, because you want to be able to get the rocket off the ground. The shield can't be too heavy, and it operates at high temperatures. Anyway, I get a call from him, and he says, Stan, I hear you're giving lectures. Yeah, sure. Would you be interested in speaking to the local section of the American Nuclear Society? Sure. No, I mean on an expense account. I'll have to ask management about that, I said. And they said yes. They paid for me to go from Pittsburgh to Los Alamos, New Mexico, to give a lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real, without hiding it by technical discussions or other words like that, you know. And they had over 500 people at the lecture, one of their largest crowds, and there were, again, no negative questions. So I thought things were going very well. I was very pleased by that. And then we had a great test with our nuclear rocket. Westinghouse built one. Los Alamos did, and Aerojet General built one. The Westinghouse one was only 8 feet in diameter, but operated at a power level of 4,000 megawatts. That's twice the power of Hoover Dam, in case you're wondering.
Well, I was actually kind of curious about that, but that's a crazy visual.
Well, and it was the exhaust temperature. You take cold liquid hydrogen and you run it, heat it in the reactor, and it comes out at over 4,000 degrees.
Oh, my gosh.
It was incredible. And, of course, our test was successful, about the same temperature, lower power, at Westinghouse and Aerojet also. And then they canceled the program.
That's just crazy, man. That's crazy.
Well, look, don't ask me to explain it because I don't have an explanation.
Right.
NASA didn't have any leadership. It was the Space Nuclear Propulsion Office. But I thought I was on to the best possible job. When I got laid off, I was looking for a job, and I found somebody, McDonnell Douglas in California. He was on the Manned Orbiting Laboratory program. It was a competitor to the space station. And I applied and got a job, and they were using money from the MOL program, M-O-L, blue sky money. And they could spend a couple percent on far-out research that had potentially great benefits with a small expenditure. My job was going to be to figure out how flying saucers worked. Who could ask for anything more?
That's awesome.
Well, I spoke too soon. I was driving across the country to take up my new job when I heard on the radio the MOL program had been canceled.
So this time you didn't even get to it. It had already been canceled.
No, and I walk in with my offer letter, and she says, "You realize we just laid off 5,000 people." Yeah, I realize that. They kept me for 3 months. And I did one interesting thing was I did a literature search on magneto aerodynamics, because I think the ones operating in the atmosphere probably work by ionizing the air and then interacting with electric and magnetic fields and
it's incredible.
Controlling lift, drag, heating, sonic boom production, and radar profile. That's all.
That's all.
And I had this search done, and I was astonished to get 900 references from government report literature, not the open literature. And 90% were classified. Nose cones run into this problem. They create a plasma, and how does it affect the drag and heating and all this kind of thing. But anyway, I decided I've got to look after my own family and get on the phone booking lectures, making calls. You know, nice thing being cheapskate again. Before 8 in the morning from the West Coast at that time was pretty cheap to call back east. So I'd get on between 6 and 8 West Coast time, book a few lectures, do a mailing to 1,000 colleges or something, and then get some piggyback talks, as I called it. And I've been at it ever since. And the first lecture was in 1967, and now we're up over 700 in all 50 states, 10 provinces, and 18 countries. And I figured 3 years ago, I figured I'd answered about 60,000 questions. Probably a lot more than that. And I've only had 11 hecklers after my lectures. So my focus is on a few things that I have a peculiar background for. The objections from the nasty, noisy negativists, the term I use when I'm being polite, there isn't any evidence. So I talk about 5 large-scale scientific studies and check fewer than 2% of the people in my audiences have read any of them. Second, you can't get here from there. Well, I've worked on fission rockets. I was involved in a study of fusion rockets. rockets. Now, let's get it straight. Almost all the energy in the universe is produced by nuclear fusion. That's what goes on in all the stars. That's not a rare event. That's H-bombs, if you will. That's the same process. Yeah. But we've made real progress with things nuclear. That study said if you want to spend the dough, you can go. A third objection is governments can't keep secrets. I read something just the other day by a professor with a PhD and published 500 papers. And, oh, today with the Internet and YouTube, you can't keep secrets. Well, he's full of baloney. Classified stuff doesn't get posted in those locations.
Right.
And most people take their security oaths very seriously. They may lose their jobs if they don't. And they understand there's a national security aspect to this stuff.
Absolutely.
Surely the Russians and Chinese would like to learn whatever we've learned from the Roswell incident.
We were just, we just saw, we're looking how, me and my, the guy that does the show with me, we were reading news about how Hillary Clinton is trying to still, even to this day, get the government to release stuff from Area 51, just still stuff that...
Well, you know, she's being very cautious in what she says. Some people aren't who repeat what she says, but she's always made it clear if there wasn't a national security aspect.
Right.
And of course there is, but that's another question.
Mm-hmm. But it just goes to show that there's still so much that's buried that we aren't seeing.
Yeah, we secrets are easy to keep. Look, the U-2 was developed, to spy on Russia.
Right.
Illegally, of course, because you're flying over their airspace. But we knew that eventually the Russians would be able to shoot it down. And we started work on a satellite, a spy satellite, the Corona spy satellite, in the 1950s. And then after 12 failures, the 13th one was a success and obtained more information than all the U-2 flights that had preceded it. And you're not breaking the law when you're up at, satellite altitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Lockheed developed a stealth aircraft, $10 billion in 10 years, in secret.
That's where I used to work, actually, was Lockheed.
Oh, which one?
Well, I was working in Florida. I'm actually not in engineering. I'm in finance. So I worked in the space systems, but I worked on the financial side. But I worked in Lakeland, which was near, and I used to live near Port Canaveral.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's a lot going on.
Absolutely. It was awesome.
And, it's kind of amazing when people try to make it sound as if, oh, they can't keep secrets. Well, let me get right directly to UFOs. The National Security Agency was, sued, if you will, under a Freedom of Information Act request, they and the CIA together. And eventually, after them not wanting to release anything because sources and methods information, we can't tell you anything. Finally, there were some changes in government regulations, and they decided to release 156 top secret Umbra, can't get much higher than that, documents about UFOs, NSA documents about UFOs. There was one little problem. You could read one sentence per page. Everything else was whited out.
Right. Yeah, that's the way it was for me, too. And I was working on stuff. If I didn't have the clearance for it, it was just very specific numbers that I was allowed to see.
Yeah. The need to know is very important. And I get people who think that if you've got a clearance, you can see everything that's, let's say, secret or top secret. No, you can't.
Yeah, there's so many layers to it and levels.
Oh, yeah. And I get people tell me, those guys on Majestic 12, which I think was real, even though most of the documents are phony, flood the market with garbage and hope it rubs off on the good stuff, there are people telling me, those guys would have told their wives what they were doing. No, they wouldn't. I never told my wife anything classified. It would be stupid for me to do that. Besides losing my job, you might be helping the enemy, and, it just didn't make sense. I can't control what she says, and you don't know where the spies are. There's an old saying, you can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. And as you know, that's true.
Yeah.
Because there are lurkers out there, if you will.
Right.
And so there's another part of this, too. People can't imagine why anybody would come here and not just land on the White House lawn and share their technology with us. Think about that for a minute. I mean, in the first place, the president does not speak for 7 billion Earthlings, last I heard anyway.
Yeah.
You know, in the second place, why would any sensible civilization give their technology to a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare? That's us. I mean, we tend to forget, and I really don't know what the kids learn in school today, but in World War II, we nice guys killed 50 million of our own kind. 50 million. We destroyed 1,700 cities. Those bombers were really doing the job. And after the war, it comes as a great surprise to people, we exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. Only two of them on people, thank goodness. But yeah, it's perfectly obvious that you've been exploding a lot of bombs if you got a good radiation detection system, which these guys certainly would have.
And they were able to perfect it so much. It was fine-tuned.
Yeah, yeah. And so what I'm saying is, and for those people who think, well, there's no way you could get there from here without it taking forever, or here from there, and I like to point out that progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. The future is not an extrapolation of the past. You have to change how you do things. A laser isn't just a better light bulb. Entirely different physics.
Yeah.
You know,
it is a great point, but that's all you have. Like, the mind frames that we have is always based on the past. It's like hard to prepare yourself for something that's totally, you know, new, because you haven't had any precedent for it. So the best thing is to just be expecting that you're going to have something to happen that's unexpected.
In our book, Kathleen Martin and I have written a couple of books. We've got another one coming out in September. And we have a book called Science Was Wrong. The original title was going to be It's Impossible, Isn't It? But the publisher changed it. But anyway, 14 chapters, each one stimulated by some very smart guy saying something stupid. Well, there's a lot of that going around. Top astronomer in the country in 1903 wrote an article in which he said if there was one thing he was sure of, man would never fly any distance in a vehicle other than a balloon. That was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
I love that. That's so good.
Well, in 1956, the British astronomer Royal said space travel is utter bilge. She was speaking to Time magazine. And nobody would ever pay for that. What we need is better equipment for astronomy. And so that was a year before Sputnik. And what field of technology has benefited most from I lost where I was going with that, but anyway,
right,
there's no field more than astronomy that has benefited from the space program.
Right. It's. I mean, the Hubble was like probably the one, like one of the most like single satellites with one of the most. It's brought in more data than any other thing.
Like Kepler. Kepler's one of my.
Kepler.
Favorites.
Yeah, but it's just crazy how much it's opened. I mean, the things that we thought before we saw further out, it's unbelievable. Like, it just changed everything. Like, well, as far as the scale of everything.
Look at the question of, are there any other planets out there? Now, Frank Drake, several years ago, he's a wheel in the SETI movement. SETI stands for Silly Effort to Investigate, you know. That's my definition of it anyway, rather than search for extraterrestrial intelligence. But he was saying a few years back that there might be as many as 8,000 planets in the galaxy that could be sending us signals. Now, why they would use technology appropriate to us when we're such latecomers? First long-distance radio signal was received in 1901. Planet's been around over 4 billion years. You think nobody else got started before we did? You know, that seems rather silly. But now, with Kepler, good estimates, and it varies a little who you talk to, are that every star has, on the average, 1 to 1.6 different people, different estimates. Nobody knows. Nobody's counted them. 1 to 1.6 planets per star. So when you look at it, there are approximately 2,000 stars within 50 light years, which means of us, approximately 10,000 stars within 100 light years. And the galaxy is 100,000 light years across.
Right.
So, you know, it's pretty darn silly to think, well, Pat Robertson does, that all the intelligent life in the universe is right here on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, because you point out, it's what it is, is that's interesting is that it, as amazing and how unlikely as life is, there's, I mean, let's say that you are going to take the tiniest percentage, and then but then you apply yeah. that percentage to how many planets there are, you're still going to get more than just one. There's just such a large number.
Well, you know, science is loaded with situations in which we look at the small percentage. How many isotopes are fissionable? Well, 2 out of many hundreds, maybe. That was a good number. How many chemicals cure any disease? Darn few, but those are the ones you want if you're sick.
Right.
You know. And so in the nuclear world, my world, cross sections, probability of capturing a neutron vary by a factor of thousands. Two isotopes of the same element can vary enormously in their probability of absorbing a neutron. And if you want something that's going to poison the reactor, you pick the one that's good at absorbing instead of the one that's poor at absorbing, you know. So our whole life is, the basketball coach knows most people are not 7 feet tall. Give me one. I don't care about the rest.
Right.
I don't care about the midgets of the world.
Give me Shaq, and then I can do Penny Hardaway on the rest.
Well, yeah, you've got to be rational about how you do these things. So you know, I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures.
That's impressive. Especially considering your audience. You've already mentioned this before, but just the people you're talking to are the smartest people when it comes to, you know, space and all the what would be able to debunk this, as opposed
well, you know,
it's just crazy that only 11.
Most people think, I do something I started a long time ago. At the end of my lecture, I'll ask how many people you believe they've seen what I would consider to be a flying saucer. I prefer the term flying saucer because all flying saucers are UFOs. Not all UFOs are flying saucers. You know, all great-grandfathers are men, but not all men are great-grandfathers. Okay. I am, but that's unusual.
Right, it is.
You know, so you have to learn to focus on what's relevant. And when I ask that question, how many of you have seen one, typically 10% raise their hand. The first one's very carefully, their hand just above their head. You know, I'll make a joke. We didn't let the CIA in. It's okay. I'm not taking your name and so forth. But typically, 10% of the audience believe they've seen one. But then I ask, how many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down. And I ran a little experiment. I'm on campus doing a colloquium in the middle of the day to try to get more people out to the lecture at night. And had the professor cooperate with me. So we asked two questions of the students, but I insisted that they vote with their eyes closed. The two questions were, how many of you think most people don't believe in flying saucers? And then separately, with the professor counting the vote, voting with their eyes closed, the second question was, how many of you do believe in flying saucers? Would you believe it was 80% for both questions?
So that's like a huge misconception then, as far as what...
It's
what...
a terrible misconception. And when I ask people at my table, they want me to autograph their books and so forth, but they've got to tell me about their sighting. And so they say, I asked, did you report it? No. Why not? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. But, you know, everywhere I go, I find sightings. And when I go through that sequence, incidentally, if there are still hands left of people who have reported what they saw, I ask, how many of you were in the military at the time? There's still some hands. I say, you want to tell us about it? I don't want your name or anything, but I'm sure the audience would like to know. And I point to one person, and he says, they took my pictures. That's all he said. I said, well, I'm sure the audience would like to hear the rest of the story. You don't need to give your name, you know. And so he told about piloting an Air Force plane across the Pacific, and there was a plane 20 miles ahead that radioed back, saucer heading your way. They had gun cameras. They took pictures. They called the base to which they were going to notify them because the crew doesn't handle the film. That's intelligence information. They land. The film gets taken. They get debriefed and told never to say anything. Well, I'll guarantee you 98% of the audience believed that guy's story. He wasn't looking for anything. He hadn't made a big noise, wasn't looking for attention, but he was being honest. And as long as he was one of 10%, then he didn't need to worry about being singled out. But once I asked how many were in the military, he was honest.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is there are a lot of misconceptions. And let me get back to the propulsion thing. I'm a nuclear guy, and mm-hmm. make no bones about it, but little sequence. In 1944, a big bomb was a 10-ton blockbuster. That's what it was called. 10 tons of dynamite was the amount of energy it released, the same as that. And it makes a pretty big hole in the ground. Well, that was in 44. In 1945, we tested our first atomic bomb, a fission device, released the energy of more than 16,000 tons of dynamite, TNT, if you will. And in 1952, we exploded our first H-bomb. That released the energy of 10 million tons of dynamite. It had a 3-mile-wide fireball.
It's hard to even imagine it.
It is hard to imagine. If you drop a bomb like that in the middle of New Jersey, you would start fires from New York to Philadelphia. And having grown up in New Jersey, there are people I know who would say, hey, that's a good idea, Stan.
Yes, exactly. I live in New York City now.
So that's the Russians tested one that released the energy of 57 million tons of TNT. Now, I mention this not to say, isn't it great we can build big bombs, but to say that any sensible person knows you can use nuclear fusion for deep space propulsion. Will it be cheap? No, of course not. But I worked on a study of fusion back in 1962.
Right.
And if you want to spend the dough, you can go. These things don't come cheap.
And also it's one of those. I was going to say, that also makes the point of what you were saying by why would anybody from an extraterrestrial see what we're doing with that kind of power and be interested in giving it over to us? You know what I mean? Like, if there's...
Of course not.
If it's just...
You don't give kids, 3-year-olds, guns to play with. Maybe in Texas, but no place else, you know. No, the kicker here is they may be here to quarantine us. If you were an alien, would you want us out there? I can't imagine anybody would.
No, it's...
We're not nice guys.
I think the other thing is we don't think things through. It's just kind of a belligerent, go for it, and not think about the consequences.
Well, that's right. That's right. And I worry, as I said, I have a great-grandson. What kind of a world is he growing up? And I must say, not to be political, but... I was totally shocked when Donald Trump said we ought to have South Korea and the Japanese build their own nuclear weapons so we don't need to pay for defending them.
No, yeah. That...
I don't want to see any more countries have nuclear weapons, especially ones with like South and North Korea, where, you know, the guy's a nut.
It's I don't even know what you would call this. There's got to be some kind of psychological term for it. But we've gotten to that point where the only way to keep someone from having nuclear weapons is to have nuclear weapons to threat. You know what I mean? It's like a standstill. Yeah. It's so complicated.
Well, it's amazing that we and the Russians agreed on a moratorium on testing. there have been some sensible people in the world. I think of Reagan and Gorbachev. The fact that, you know, before them, we came very close to a nuclear war in 62. But at least those two had the sense enough to realize that, you know, we've got to be sensible here.
Yeah.
Children are too precious.
I mean, it's the planet's so sensitive. I mean, there's the it could end all so quick with that kind of power. It's crazy.
And what's gained by it? In other words, it scares me. And so I'm somebody who says, look, nuclear energy may not be the ultimate, but certainly would get us to the stars. And in a reasonable time, it may surprise you to know it only takes 1 year at 1G acceleration to get close to the speed of light. 1 year at 1G. And there's another part of Einstein that the noisy negativists don't want to talk about. As you get close to the speed of light, time slows down for things moving that fast.
That's a good point, yeah.
At 99.99% of the speed of light, you can go 37 light years in 6 months pilot time. You go out, come back, marry your granddaughter's best friend. That's real. I mean, the particles in the Large Hadron Collider over in Switzerland there, they move at 99.9999% of the speed of light. That's not a realm that we're unfamiliar with, in other words.
The crazy thing to me, though, is how I think it's called specific relativity, right? Where it's no matter how fast you're going, that the speed of light's always the same, like in relative to the speed you're going. Like it doesn't. You would think that, like,
you get closer, but you never quite get. You don't cross the line.
Right. It's just so. It's so that part of the speed of
mind-boggling.
Yeah, it just blows. It doesn't make any sense. But it also opens up the. It just pretty much sets free a whole aspect of that is just untouched.
Sure.
We haven't even begun to grasp kind of how that works because we haven't even, you know, like there's not. There hasn't been anything to push that yet.
It's a question of money, and I frankly don't think we should be. We got other problems on this planet. How many kids died yesterday of preventable disease or starvation?
Yeah.
And how can we be happy about spending $1 trillion on things military this year? $1 trillion? That's scary stuff. So
yeah.
We've got some learning to do, I think.
There's a big joke between I listen to the Star Talk radio with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and he sometimes has on Bill Nye and some people from NASA, and they talk about how we're so concerned about trying to colonize Mars when we should be spending that exact amount of energy on fixing our own planet rather than going and messing up another one.
Well, yeah. The problem here is, and one of the biggest reasons governments don't want to release data is that undoubtedly the younger generation would push for a new view of ourselves instead of as Americans, Canadians, Greeks, Peruvians, Indians, whatever, as Earthlings.
Right.
There's no government that wants to give up power.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the segregation
look
is just, it makes it impossible to do anything.
Yeah. So we've got to develop a new solution to the problem. How do we get along on the darn planet instead of making a mess out of it? And, it you know, try to see ourselves as others see us.
Right.
And that's not always easy, but I think it may be necessary. It's a serious question.
It's...
How do we get past the point of people threatening other people with nuclear weapons? Gee whiz.
It seems like a simple thing, but somehow we make it complicated. Well, hey, one thing. I know that we're kind of running out of time, and I did want to ask you about this. We had Mark Sargent on a few weeks ago, and he was bringing up a lot of points about his theory on flat Earth. And I saw that you debated him, and I listened to that debate. And I wanted to give you a chance to just really briefly kind of give your opinion on that and if there's any credence to it.
I was surprised that there's such a strong movement, but that there's such a lack of evidence. There's research by proclamation. In effect, they're saying that all the astronauts have lied. Look, my book, Flying Saucers and Science, the foreword was written by Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the recently deceased astronaut. I don't think he lied. I think he did go to the moon. I really do think he walked on the moon.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of other things that are said to be, you know, they have the sun and the moon being the same size, as some people say, and there's a whole bunch of other research by proclamation.
That was my biggest problem, too. It seemed like all the research, when I looked up what he was bringing up, there's the people that were doing it were using, I don't know, they just very simplistic methods. And they didn't. Yes. There wasn't enough. Like they just. I don't know. You're comparing somebody in their backyard with like a heat gun or like a measuring gun to like universities that are spending so much money. I don't know. It's hard to believe that the side that has the backyard experiments is really the one that's right. That was my biggest quelp with it. Was just some of the evidence based on experiments. But
crazy. Very disappointed. And I was shocked in the first place, but then realized that they were saying as true a whole bunch of things that I had no reason to believe were true, and that we've accomplished a great deal. The fact that we understand what goes on in the stars.
That to me, too. The answers that it gives us that scientists were able to predict. I mean, that's the biggest tool of science is being able to predict things.
Yes.
And it just doesn't make any sense to me that would just be all part of some kind of like lie that they would have, that we would figure it out. Then they'd have to continue to in the program the whatever we figured out to continue happen. It's just, it's so complicated. And I'm a believer in simplicity. The more simple, the more likely. If you have to do a bunch
I'm with you.
It's just
so it's not that that's the only bad idea out there.
Oh, right. The one thing that I did like, though, is that it does get people getting into that mindset of not taking things for granted, because I think a lot of people do believe the world is round for no good reason, even though I think there is good reasons. I don't think that the average person even really thinks about it. They just
it's not something you think about. You take it for granted, and I realize that taking things for granted is not a good idea.
Right. So I did respect that about him, and I thought it was really cool that he was willing to step out like that and to push. So that part was just, it was really commendable. But I mean, on the other side of it, it was just very, it's hard to swallow, I guess. Just with, I mean, you'd have to, like I said, I grew up right next to Cape Canaveral, and to think that every single rocket launch that I saw was some kind of hoax is a lot. But it's great. It's good to see that. But
one thing I haven't done is give out my website.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was about to say if you could kind of as we wrap up now, if you could mention some things that you're doing, and then also how people could get a little
more. I'm working on a new book with Kathleen Martin. It'll be out in September. Keep your eyes open for it. My website is www.stantonfriedman, FRIEDMAN.com. And one thing you can get I've got several books out there, and they all get sent out autographed, which you can't get on Amazon. And we covered a lot of ground. Kathleen Martin did most of the work on our book, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, which is a fascinating story. The first abduction to get a lot of serious attention.
Right.
My book on flying saucers and science goes into the scientific questions. We did a book, Science Was Wrong, as I said, and that was kind of fascinating. We each did 7 chapters of the 14. And the new book will be covering some of the things wrong with UFO debunkers, with their approach, their attitude, and so forth. So there's a lot going on, and I will be, I was at last year's MUFON conference. I'll be in Roswell this year, of course, because I'm the original civilian investigator, Roswell.
Absolutely. I was hoping to get to that, but maybe we'll
crash at Corona.
Hopefully we'll get a chance to have you back on, because I did want to ask you more about that next time we have an opportunity to have a conversation, because that's a crazy thing to have as a claim, the original civilian investigator to the biggest the biggest incident in all of the UFO culture. That's awesome.
And the museum is great down there, and early July, everybody's welcome. There'll be thousands of people.
That's what me and the Brandon, who I do this podcast with, we really want to get a chance to go to do that sometime.
It's but worth we'll, getting to.
We for sure, and we'll include all these links that you're mentioning in the okay. the notes for this one, good. So people will be able to link to it. But thank you so much for this opportunity.
My
we
point.
Love talking to you. It's always nice to talk to someone that's smarter than us because we're not that smart, but we want our listeners to get to hear about it. That's awesome. And I think the coolest thing about your perspective on this is just how much of the science you bring to it and the fact that you've pretty much been proclaiming this to other scientists. It's like within the community that you're kind of ushering this in.
I try.
It's very cool. And that's kind of the people that need to be hearing about it because they're the ones that are actually going to be able to push it to get to that where we're using the technology that we have to start figuring this stuff out. But I am also with you on that we need to get on fixing this planet as a priority. There's so many things that are just – the last thing that we should be worrying about is trying to utilize alien technology for military. We just need to be fixing this thing. But thank you so much.
Thank
you so much for your time.
Thank you. Good night.
All right. Good night.
Well, first, very impressed with you. You really showed your stuff out there tonight, and I really appreciate it. Two, what a fascinating and smart man he is.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how I feel.
He's somebody that I would like to get on again. I mean, to be the first citizen investigator of the Roswell incident, that's a claim that I need to get into more.
Yeah.
I mean, also, he's spoken at the UN twice, Bran. Two times.
Yeah.
That's a lot of times to be talking to the UN about aliens.
That's a lot of times. You know, and Dave, say what you will about you. You're really good. I feel like you should just take over this show and just do it all by yourself from now on.
Or we like,
I really feel
like a seesaw, like where it's like, my turn, your turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's hard when you're interviewing somebody and you're not next to each other because you really got to figure out who's asking what.
That's true.
I wanted people to get a little insight on what we do.
We do
on
it week textually, to week. Don't we?
Yeah, textually.
Yeah.
Dave, just really proud of you. Really happy you did that. And big thanks to Stan, for coming on the show.
Stan Friedman. I like that guy. And you know what was great, Brand? He's like, is this, how long is this going to be? And I was like, I thought he was going to be like, because I need to go to bed, you know? It's getting late. He's like, because I got another show at 11. That's what I'm talking about.
Love that. What a great guy.
That's what you can only hope for.
Yeah. So. It really is. Yeah. Yeah. I got another show I got to do. So.
And like, it's just like, you know, lots of shows in a night, making sure you get them all in. But he's a self-proclaimed and publicly agreed upon with this that he's the Mr. UFO. He's the man with the knowledge. So, you know, people got to.
Well, great job, Dave. Great job getting him. Great job interviewing. Great job all around. You get my seal of approval.
Thanks for the seal, Bran.
You got it, buddy.
Well, anyways, Bran, I don't want you to like get hurt while you're driving still, right?
Yeah.
Don't hurt yourself there. Okay, so.
Well, thanks, buddy. Thanks for calling me. Thanks for letting me be on the show today. I know you didn't have to, and so I just really appreciate it.
Nice signal is what I was going to say.
Okay. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye, team.